This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
La, 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 la.
Oh, you have it way better than me.
La, la, la. I sound like a cat. I sound sick.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast.
La, 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 la. Is that
that's
scary?
That's pretty good.
Enough?
That's
too scary.
That's pretty creepy.
Maybe too young. I sound like a baby.
Oh, well.
I'll get try
speaking
it again
of
later.
Babies, that's relevant.
Hey, good transition.
Anyway,
this is the Bechdel cast. My name is Jamie Loftus.
My name is Caitlin Durante.
And this is the Bechdel cast. La, 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 la,
la, la, la, la. We're talking about La La Land. Just kidding.
No. I'm not ready to talk about La La Land.
I will never be
not
ready
today.
To talk about La La Land.
Not today.
The movie we are talking about, though, is Rosemary's Baby, and we'll jump into that in
yes.
a moment. Before that, we'll just give you a quick overview of what the show is. We talk about the portrayal and representation and treatment of women in movies. Mm-hmm. We use the Bechdel test as a jumping off point to initiate that larger conversation. And the Bechdel test is, of course, a media metric created by cartoonist Alison Bechdel
yes.
That requires that two female-identifying characters,
mm-hmm.
they must have names, they must speak to each other in the story that they're in, and that conversation cannot be about men.
Right.
And then for us, it's just like a two-line exchange.
Let's demonstrate it.
Alrighty.
Hey, Caitlin.
Hey, Jamie.
How'd you really feel about the la-la-las that I was serving?
I felt that I have some notes.
Okay. I'm ready to receive.
I think just like keep practicing and you'll see improvement.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yes,
you're
welcome.
Thank you so much. That was a really compelling, I think that's maybe our most compelling, like there was some tension because I'm not good at receiving criticism. There was a lot going on.
Sure. It was a very rich conversation.
Mm-hmm. It was good. It was
yeah.
good. We're good at this. Okay. Rosemary's Baby.
We should introduce our guest before we go
yes.
any further.
I'm so thrilled that she's here.
Yes, me too. She is an actor. You know her from many films, including both Suspiria films, as well as My Favorite Year. And she has a new podcast. It's a 10-episode memoir of her childhood called Winnetka. It is Jessica Harper. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. We're so happy to have you.
We're psyched you're here.
Thanks.
And we're talking about Rosemary's Baby.
I love this. So fun.
So tell us your history, your relationship with this movie.
I first saw it, I think, when it came out, which mm-hmm. was...
68.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. This dates me. I was a fully grown person in 1968. And I was trying to remember yesterday, how did I react?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my reaction to it now, of course, having rewatched it yesterday,
mm-hmm.
which was so much fun. But my reaction to it, I believe, was so different to what it was. Because in 68, pre-feminism, you'd have a very different take on this movie.
Certainly.
So in 68, when I first saw it, I was just simply horrified.
Sure.
And yesterday, I was horrified with a whole lot of interesting side notes.
You know? Yes.
Which I'm sure we'll get into.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. But it's a fabulous movie.
It is a well-crafted
really
movie.
Well-crafted.
Yeah.
So well-written. The direction is incredible, even though there are some people who might not like the director anymore.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that as well.
Yeah. There'll be some strong cases
My history is I saw it for the first time in college as a young film buff, mm-hmm. and so that was probably around 14 years ago, mm-hmm. and I think I only saw it that once before revisiting it for the podcast, but I remember really liking it, because as far as horror films go, I'm not such a huge fan of slashers, but I love anything that has to do with the occult and satanic stuff. Don't know why I never revisited it, but I really enjoyed it, but it was just that one time that I had seen it. Mm-hmm. What about you, Jamie?
I had not seen this movie mm-hmm. Before. It's like one of those movies that has been, recommended to this show and to me specifically for years. But I think by the time I was aware of this movie, I was also aware of all the Polanski stuff, and I kind of avoided it for
sure.
That reason,
mm-hmm.
which is it's so weird, because going into this movie, I was almost like, I kind of hope I don't like it,
mm-hmm.
because then it will be a lot easier to have the, it's always easy to have an artist discussion if you don't like the art anyways.
Right.
And you're like, oh, well, it mm-hmm. sucks. And he sucks. And so put it all in the trash. But it was this was a challenging watch in a lot of ways, because there's a lot about this movie to love. I had been avoiding it because I was aware of all of the allegations before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just try to navigate around. There's a million movies. You can watch anything. But I enjoyed it, and I feel weird.
I know. I have such complicated feelings. Usually, before we even start the episode, I have a fairly good idea of what nipple rating I'm going to give it. I have no idea. I think it's going to take whatever discussion we have to
unpack. We're going to have to really
unpack.
We're going
to
have to
today.
Dig really deep, girls.
Because I feel very conflicted and challenged by this movie.
Mm-hmm. And this is, and Jessica, you were starting to get at it. I think that there's so much context to this movie that's important to how you interpret it. And it's I can't imagine seeing this movie 10 years ago.
Well, because when I saw it for the first time, if anyone was talking about Roman Polanski and his horrific crimes, I wasn't aware of it. I didn't really know. It was years later until I started hearing things about that. So,
what year was the? That was much, much later. I was just going to say the Sharon Tate, murders and all. Was he?
No, it's the year after the Sharon Tate murders are 69.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so the big sympathy for Roman hadn't really kicked in yet when this came out, if you know what I mean.
Right, right.
There was a whole big poor Roman era.
Right,
right.
And then it became fuck Roman.
Tate murders.
Yeah, that morphed into something entirely new much later.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tate murders were in 1969, and then his allegations start, I think, in the late 70s.
That sounds right.
And then he is still technically, I don't know what the word is for what he can't come back to this country.
Mm-mm.
No.
Without getting arrested.
No.
Because he admitted that he committed.
Oh, and we'll talk about that
so
more. There's so much.
So many.
Okay, so without much further ado, I'll get through the recap as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And feel free to weigh in at any point in the recap, because this movie's crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy, and it's long.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are introduced to a married couple, Rosemary, that's Mia Farrow's character, mm-hmm. and Guy, that's John Cassavetes.
John Cassavetes.
Hot.
So hot.
So hot. It's
oh
like,
my God.
It's upsetting.
It is upsetting.
I mainly learned
son
about
of
him.
A bitch.
I know. It's
how long did it take? Okay, we'll get into it. How long did it take him to sell that first baby to the devil? Like 20 seconds. He was like, oh, okay,
like so fast. Yeah.
Okay. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I mainly knew about John Cassavetes through like film school, like textbook stuff and all of his directorial work. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, wait, no one told me he was hot. Like that.
Unfortunately, he is hot.
He's so hot. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're looking for an apartment together to move into in New York City. Ever heard of it?
Ooh.
They're looking at this one giant apartment. Yes. I don't know how they end up affording it because he is a struggling actor.
That's
and
what
she
I was
is a homemaker.
Too. Like, who can live in the Dakota? It's the Dakota. It's the, where
right,
John
which is
Lennon
like overlooking like
John Lennon lived
Central
and died.
Park.
Oh
and
my
stuff.
Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's this like enormous apartment.
Yeah. Iconic.
And they can afford it somehow, even before they get mixed up with
Yeah, there was a little suspension of disbelief there.
Right.
Maybe just rent on haunted apartments is really low.
Maybe. So one of the first things I notice about this apartment is that there is a closet that's blocked by a large piece of furniture, and that'll mm-hmm. become important later, believe it or not.
And Rosemary notices too.
Yes.
She's so active in the movie. I was so ready to be like, Polanski? She's so active. Okay.
Yeah. So then a friend of theirs, Hutch, tells them that this building that they're moving into called the Bramford had a bunch of weird shit happen in it. There were sisters who cooked and ate children. There was a guy who practiced witchcraft and who have claimed to have conjured up the devil there. So they're like, whatever, we'll move in anyway.
It happens every time you move somewhere. Right. It's like there's every place has its detriment.
Everybody has some child eaters in it. Every building.
So they move in, and then Rosemary meets one of her neighbors, Terry, and one night...
Poor Terry.
Poor Terry.
Poor Terry.
Yeah.
They have this great, spoiler alert, Bechdel test passing
yes,
exchange.
They do.
In the laundry room.
Even if it was about doing laundry.
It was.
Right? Let's not forget that.
Nope. Still domestic overtones.
Yes.
Terry. I was in the middle. I was like Googling stuff in real time as I was watching. And I was like in the middle of looking up Terry. And then...
Goodbye.
You find out what happens to Terry. I was
Goodbye,
like, oh,
Terry.
Damn, yeah. Terry, too soon.
And the person that Rosemary mistakes her for, an actress and model named, was it Vicky? It was some, anyway, that's actually who plays that character.
Oh, that's funny.
I forget the name. Oh. So this isn't a good story. But she's like, hey, aren't you like, thank you, super producer Sophie. She's like, aren't you Victoria Vetri? And she's like, no, I'm not. But guess what? Victoria Vetri plays that part.
See, there's so many little
but
tricks
she's credited
like that
as a different role, different name. But
anyway. Another fun fact about that actor is that I was like, when I saw her on screen, I was like, oh, I recognize her from something. She was a Playmate Model of the Year under a different name the year this movie came out.
Huh.
Which like a lot of Playmates would do back in the day is like use different names. But she was Angela Dorian, same lady.
Right on.
Wild.
Okay.
R.I.P. Terry.
Is there a Dorian Gray reference there? Is that who's hanging in the closet
maybe.
With the thing? All kinds of sneaky references in this movie.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. And then so after they've moved in, Rosemary and Guy hear some like strange chanting coming from next door. And then a short time later, Terry commits suicide by jumping out of a window. And she had said, oh, I live with this older couple, the Cassavetes, which is confusing because John Cassavetes is in this movie and their name is the Cassavetes. Anyway, she's like, yeah, they were a family to me. They brought me in. And then she commits suicide. So something is amiss here. And then they meet this couple, Roman.
Well, they say she commits suicide. We don't really know what happened. Right?
We don't know what happened.
We never really find out.
No.
Yeah,
we have
true.
Our suspicions, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Suicide not being one of them.
Yeah.
And she has this necklace with a charm on it.
A stinky necklace?
A stinky necklace.
I love the detail that the necklace
stunk.
Yeah.
Especially when that receptionist at the end is just like, yeah, everyone in this office smells crazy.
Like,
you're just like, oh my God.
So then they meet Roman and Minnie Cassavet and...
Wait, can I just interject
sure.
one thing?
Mm-hmm.
So in this little bauble, this jewel that's hanging around her neck, inside it is a root called tannis.
Tannis root, mm-hmm. yes.
Which is very important because later, Rosemary holds this thing up to the mirror and she says, tannis anyone? Which is one of my favorite lines in the movie.
It's great. It's great.
She talks to herself a lot in this movie.
I know. Well, it's either her or Minnie, and I mean, I'd pick me over Minnie.
Yeah,
who can she trust?
Right.
She can't trust anyone. But, I mean, Ruth Gordon.
She's so great.
Oh, mm-hmm. So great. She's so good.
Yes. So they meet the neighbors, and Rosemary and Guy go over to dinner at the Castevets, and Guy is like reluctant at first, but then they start hanging out with them more and more, and the Castevets are getting a little clingy. Meanwhile, Guy is like, Rosemary, let's have a baby, and then she's very excited.
Right, because she wanted that, and then was
all she's about, apparently.
Yeah, it seems to be her one
whole thing.
It's like we don't know a lot about her out of her wanting to be a mother.
So interesting.
Why is that?
Maybe because it was written by men.
Yeah, in 1966, by the way.
Right. So the more time they spend with the Castevets, the more weird things are happening, like Guy, who is an actor and who was up for a part, gets it because the other guy who was up for that part suddenly goes blind. Mm-hmm. And then Minnie brings over this dessert, which she calls Chocolate Mouse, which is just mousse. And it makes Rosemary all woozy. And she notices this like chalky undertaste. And then she eats a little bit, but not all of it. But then she passes out anyway, presumably from having eaten this. And then there's this dreamlike sequence in which she is surrounded by naked people who are chanting, and that they're tying her to a bed, and her husband Guy is there, and the Castevets are there, and they're all participating in what seems like some sort of demonic ritual.
They're nude, but they're also talking to each other. It's like, I was like, is this chill or not? Like, I know it's not chill, but they were all just like standing in the nude, like, hey, is she awake? And then it's very casual. They're like, yeah.
Okay. Very chill. A demon looking guy rapes Rosemary.
Yes.
And then she wakes up. She's covered in scratches. And then Guy is like,
this scene is like, oof. I have to watch this scene like 4 or 5 times. It is
We have to. We will spend a lot of time unpacking this scene, I'm sure. But it's basically wild. He's like, I had sex with you last night while you were sleeping. I didn't want to miss baby night. And she's like, oh. And then,
I mean, worth mentioning.
Okay, no problem.
Marital rape is legal in New York till 1984.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll spend a lot of time unpacking that. Yep. And then Rosemary goes to a doctor, Dr. Hill, and finds out that she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then Guy insists on telling the Castevets right away. It's like the first thing he does. And then they recommend that she see a different obstetrician, Dr. Saperstein. Mm-hmm. And then she's having a lot of pain with her pregnancy. She's losing weight. Everyone keeps telling her that she looks like shit.
Everyone keeps telling her she looks like
yes.
shit.
Yes.
Everybody.
It's the
You look like chalk. You look like death warmed at one after the next.
It's so horrible. It's and it's like the one, and I'm sure we'll get to this too, but like the one choice that she makes without consulting anybody is her haircut.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is so mean to
everyone
her.
Everyone hates the haircut.
We have to, like, yeah, that's another unpacking. The thing about the haircut, like, what?
The one, but it's like the one thing she does without checking in with anyone, and everyone's like, ugh.
Yeah.
Like, even her friend.
Yeah. So then Hutch comes back, and he wants to talk to Rosemary.
But he also
alone.
Hates her haircut.
He does hate her haircut, and he comments on her weight a lot.
Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to like him.
Yeah, right. But then when she goes to meet up with him, because he feels that something's wrong with this situation, and when she goes to meet up with him, she discovers that he has suddenly fallen into a coma. Mm-hmm. And then her pains are getting worse, and she wants less and less to do with the Castevets, and she doesn't want to go to Dr. Saperstein anymore. She stops drinking the herbal drink that Minnie has been making her. Mm-hmm. And then Guy does not react well to this. He is furious. And then at a party that she insists on throwing and insists on not inviting the Castevets to.
Or the Sapersteins, or like anyone who's involved in the shadiness.
Mm-hmm. Her friends, like, give her a regular drink, and then the pain goes away. It's unclear exactly what causes the pain to go away. You know, maybe it's witchcraft. We're not sure.
We don't know.
But it goes away. because she's threatening, like, I'm never going to go to Saperstein again. And then suddenly the pain vanishes.
And we get a brief scene with her and her friends, which I was waiting for the whole time. I know. Like, where are her friends?
Right. And she didn't seem to have any besties anywhere.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there they are at the party.
There they are. I'm like, well, did we learn what their names were? But either way, there's a good scene. It's like they're immediately responsive to her pain. They're immediately like, no, this doesn't sound like what should be happening. They make sure Guy stays out of the room. And that interaction empowers Rosemary a little bit to stand up to Guy, who immediately is like, you're never going to see your friends again. Sorry. Yeah. You know, like, and calls them dumb bitches. And,
yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Feminist icon Guy.
I know. Also, his name is literally Guy.
Guy.
That's right. Yeah, that's what I love.
And then we cut immediately to a few months later. And now she is pregnant as hell.
She's thriving.
And
in the moo-moo.
Yeah, they're making preparations for the baby. They're making this nursery and everything. And then her friend Hutch dies. And his friend gives Rosemary a book that Hutch wanted her to have called
All of Them Witches.
Yep. And then Rosemary's told that the name is an anagram. And she figures out that it's not the name of the book, but it's the name of someone in the book, Stephen Marcato. And it anagrams to Roman Castevet.
No.
Ah.
Why are criminals got to keep using that? Criminals should just stop doing anagrams. Just make up something
It's
new.
So interesting, too, because as you pointed out, his last name is very close to Cassavetes.
Yes.
And that's obviously a thing they thought and laughed about before they shot the movie, right? And then, you know, which came first, the name or the anagram? So they go, okay, the title is going to be this, so let's see, how can we... And there's so many name games in this thing. The Roman... The bad guy next door is named Roman, of course.
Yeah.
And which can play into this whole thing about what happened later in the 70s and how the devil man and so on. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as you said, her husband's name is Guy. It's totally a generic word for dude.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And she's Rosemary, like the Virgin Mary. Oh, my God. It goes on and on.
There's so much.
Rosemary is also an herb. There's a lot of herbs.
Rosemary, a stinky herb.
Yeah. Also, this is a great time to point out that my name, Caitlin Durante, anagrams to a number of things. Uh-huh. You've got Latin dancer UTI.
Love that one.
You've got cat turd in line. You've got
awesome. There's the best ones.
There's a bunch.
Well, I'm gonna go do anagram myself
it's
later.
It's fun. It's really fun. Yeah. Anyway, so in the book, she learns that Roman's father was a witch who performs rituals and uses, like, baby's blood because it's the most powerful blood to use.
Sure.
So Rosemary tells Guy about all of this, and then she's like, I never want to see the Castevets again. My baby's in danger. We're going to move out. And then she goes to Dr. Saperstein and tells him about all of this. Mm-hmm. And he tells her that Roman is ill and that he doesn't have long to live. And she's like, okay, well, maybe this will solve my problems if he just dies and is out of the picture. So Guy and Rosemary see the Castevets off because they're going to be traveling to all these different places because he's a world traveler.
Yeah.
And then Guy throws out the book that Hutch gave Rosemary. So she goes and gets more books about witchcraft and sort of confirms a suspicion that she had that the coven was responsible for the other actor being blinded.
She basically hacks pre-computers.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is going to a bookstore.
Just doing some research.
Major hacking sequence. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So she realizes things are really amok here, and she packs up her things and she goes to see Dr. Saperstein again, but then she realizes that he's in on it too because of the stinky herb.
Stinky necklace.
He's got the tannis too. Tannis, yep. Anyone.
Mm-hmm. God. Feminist icon, the receptionist, mm-hmm. who's just like, you smell bad, just like my boss.
She's like, oh no.
Who doesn't say that when you walk into it?
Yeah. I was like, well, maybe a little unprofessional, but helpful to the plot.
So she runs out and she goes back to Dr. Hill and tells him everything. Like, she thinks the guy has promised the coven her baby in exchange for his success as an actor. And then it seems like Dr. Hill is going to help, but instead he calls Guy and Dr. Saperstein, and then they come and get her.
She's hysterical.
Right.
Yeah.
They take her back home, and then she tries to get away, but it doesn't work. She goes into labor, and then Saperstein gives her sedative and she passes out. She wakes up. The baby's been born. She's like, where's my baby? They're like, the baby died. Sorry. And she knows that they're lying. But
you can hear a baby crying right. in the other room. I was like, do you guys not have a second location to go to?
Right.
Yeah. Not a foolproof plan.
Yeah.
And then guys all like, you have the prepartum crazies.
God.
So, yeah, she hears the baby crying. And then she remembers that closet that the big piece of furniture was in front of. Mm-hmm. She's like,
devil's closet. There you go.
She goes into it and she realizes that there is a door behind this, like, I guess, partition kind of thing. And she goes into this creepy apartment and the coven is there, including Guy and the cast of vets.
And a satanic bassinet.
Yeah, it's like black. It's all black.
That must have been fun for the art director.
Totally. Richard Silbert, by the way. Mm. Incredible.
And then there's a baby in the cradle.
We don't see it.
She looks into it and we see her horrified reaction. And she's like, what have you done to its eyes? And then Roman, who is not dead, by the way, mm-hmm. and who is not traveling. And he's like, he has his father's eyes. Satan is the father, not Guy. Satan chose you because you're the cutest woman in New York.
That's what everyone says. People should say that on Tinder dates. Satan chose you. You're the most charming girl in Los Angeles.
And apparently the most clueless, too.
Yeah. And then Guy's like, Guy at the end is very, I mean, I guess if we're going like a reverse nativity deal, he like Joseph, is pretty thrilled to be cucked by a higher power.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, it's not my baby.
Yeah, he just didn't care nearly enough about that.
Not hardly at all. No. Yeah.
I was like, just take a sure, class,
we
Guy.
We can make more. We can make more babies. Yeah. We'll move to Beverly Hills. They have babies there.
Oh, yeah. And then they're chanting Hail Satan. And then Roman is like, hey, Rosemary, why don't you be a mother to this baby? At first, she's like, ew, no. But then she's like, okay.
Maybe.
And that is the end of the movie.
Yes.
Dun, 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 dun.
La, 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 la,
la. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come right back to discuss.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Celebrate the end of your workday with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as another busy Thursday flies by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
And we are back.
Woo. I mean, where to begin?
I don't know.
We've all three of us have established that we enjoy the movie.
Mm-hmm. And admire the craft.
Yes.
Can we just say one thing? Mm-hmm. The music Christoph Komeda. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that totally wrong. Mm-hmm. The music, the score is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I guess going into the behind-the-scenes lore surrounding this movie, he died a pretty brutal death less than a year after this movie came out.
Really?
Yeah. The composer?
The composer. Oh. Died. Yeah. There's a lot of, like, strange stuff. What's one of those? One of those.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, so this is, you know, a highly regarded prestige horror psychological thriller.
Yes.
Like, in 2014, it was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. It's still shown in theaters. Like,
they
this
tried
is...
to reboot it with Zoe Saldana. Didn't work out.
Oh.
In 2014 also. Huh. Should we just tackle the art versus artist right at the top, and then we can talk about the characters? Because I feel like if we don't talk about it now, it will just haunt the rest of the conversation.
Sure, yes. In terms of Roman Polanski, the director of this film.
And the writer of the film.
Yes, he wrote and directed it, and it was adapted from a novel written by Ira Levin.
Who we'll get to.
Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about him, so I'm interested to learn about that. So Roman Polanski, he had a troubled past. You know, he was a Holocaust survivor. His parents were taken in raids during the Holocaust.
A year after this movie comes out, the Manson family brutally murders his wife Sharon Tate and some of his friends. And yes, definitely right. went through some shit, to
yes.
say the least.
But it is no excuse for what he did,
yes.
which is he statutory raped a lot of underage girls.
Mm-hmm.
And he admitted it, at
he
least.
He was convicted in 1978, I believe, of statutory rape.
Yeah, 77, 78. He was arrested and charged with drugging and raping a 13-year-old girl. And then a short time later, he fled to Paris after learning that the judge planned to imprison him rather than just give him some other lesser punishment.
Right.
But
so he's been a fugitive for about 40 years.
Several decades, yeah.
And in that time, he has won another Oscar. Is that correct?
Oh, maybe. I
believe I
don't know
he won
that.
For The Pianist in 2002.
Fuck. Yeah.
So that's fun.
Also, since that time, several other women have come forward saying that he raped them while they were underage. So.
Good Lord.
He's also been celebrated in the recent years in Europe as well. I mean,
yes.
he doesn't stop getting awards.
He does not.
No, he doesn't stop working. I mean,
no.
It seems like he's very infrequently stopped working at all. He did win an Academy Award in 2002 for The Pianist. Like, he's continued to work. He just can't come back to the United States. And it wasn't until last year that, like, post Me Too, that he was finally removed from the Academy. But that's not even to say that that's a permanent thing. It's like a
time out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, as so many people who perpetrate stuff like this get, mm-hmm. is just a brief timeout. I mean, that's the fact that the worst thing that has happened as a result of all of this is that he couldn't be in the Academy 40 years after being convicted and confessing a crime like that is just absurd.
Right.
La, 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 la,
sorry.
No, that's all right.
It's fine.
Yeah, his punishment is basically that he still gets to keep working and living in Europe.
And he lives
Boo-hoo.
In, like, Paris. It's,
yeah.
It's, like, one of the more upsetting examples in an industry that is, you know, littered with them.
Can I also read a quote of his that I found?
Oh, sure. Oh, I wonder if it's the same. Yeah.
He is speaking to Clive James. This is in 1984. He says, "Women these days wear a virtual armor. Tights, panties, blue jeans, belt, as though they were afraid of constant aggression. There must be something psychological at the bottom of it."
Ooh, I've got another quote from him from when he's 79. He said, "The pill has changed greatly the women of our times. It masculinizes her. It chases away the romance from our lives." And then he says, "Trying to level genders is, quote, idiotic." It's crazy that he made this movie,
right.
if that is how he feels.
That is crazy.
And
yes.
then this is Code of Ethics.
Because, I mean, I think there are a few different reads of this movie, but largely this is a story about a woman who's been emotionally, psychologically, and sexually abused and who is trying to, like, regain agency over her body and her pregnancy and her life.
Right.
she doesn't do it successfully, but...
Well, she's also, again, having, as I said, being the person in the room here who was a grown-up in 66,
mm-hmm. yeah.
she was, and it really was, I'm not pre-feminist entirely, obviously, feminists lived long before that, but before it became, you know, before, say, Ms. Magazine was published, mm. which was my... aha moment.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
I remember the day I read the first issue of Ms. Magazine. I'm sitting in the steps outside my apartment. I'm reading it. And I got so angry. I went into a fury. And I've never stopped the fury.
Good.
Anyway, it was, but in 66, it was still like, you. As I said, I saw the movie and that woman looked like people I actually kind of knew. Like, she had no ambition, no career, no employment, no interest in any such thing.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, as we pointed out, no like besties. I mean, she didn't even, yeah. she had nothing except this craving to have a baby,
right,
which
yeah.
sets you up for her willingness to accept this poor little devil baby. But
right.
So it works for the story, but it's just, you know, again, looking at it now versus looking in 66, you go, oh, that reminds me of my friend Heather, or mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at it and you go, I don't know anybody like this. This
right.
is insane. And, you know, he takes the book away from her, and he's just so dominating, and she's yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, to her husband.
There's yeah. that scene where he, like, wakes her up, and he's like, it's 9:00. He doesn't say make me breakfast, but mm-hmm. that's what's
yeah.
implied.
He doesn't have to
and
say
she,
it.
Yeah, she's yeah. like, go eat out, and he's like, hell I will. So, like, yeah, she is just, like, this very... traditional, like, homemaker housewife type, and women who want to be mothers, women who are homemakers, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that if that is the life they choose.
Sure.
The fact that she is given no other characteristics or interests or
it's just
desires.
It's treated as a given. And
yeah.
I feel like that's the
yeah, and
thing.
She doesn't even have any hobbies. So it, in a way, she's kind of, I mean, really kind of a one-dimensional.
Right.
You know, you'd think there would be something.
Everything and we see her do is just very domestic. I mean, she's preparing the nursery. She's, like, redecorating the house and stuff like that. And, again, those things, those activities are all fine to do, but the fact that we don't see her...
And it's frustrating because I think that, like, the story at so many times indicates that she is very smart and very capable because she... you know, sees through this huge ruse. And she, like, I listed out all the different times that she clocks things and notices things that other people don't and then follows up on it later and tries to get more information. It seems like with this character that the big hurdle for her is that she wants to figure out what's going on, but she wants to do it in a way that's polite and doesn't hurt anyone's feelings.
Right.
And so at the time I was just like, Rosemary, no! Like, where after she figures out right away that when she's given the chocolate mousse mm-hmm. by Minnie and she's like, this tastes wrong. Like, something
yeah.
is, they're not poisoning me correctly. And, you know, Guy starts to gaslight her immediately. He's like, it's always something, like, you gotta just eat it, whatever. And she goes back the next morning after she is raped and knows that, but she goes back to Minnie and brings back the dishes and is like, thank you, I really liked it, it was really good. And it's like, she's part of what really, like, broke my heart about her character is that she always knows that something is wrong and she is always aware of her own pain, but is allowing herself to be talked out of it because she doesn't want to hurt other people or mm-hmm. because she's, like, doubting her own.
Because mm-hmm. like, women are conditioned to be accommodating and polite and
right.
all that. And, I mean, we can't ignore the cultural and historical time that this comes out in, this movie, this
sure.
that it's set in. I mean, it's set in 65 into 66. And, mm-hmm. you know, second wave feminism was kind of... gearing
just
up
starting
nation.
Yeah
yeah
yeah as you said, Jessica, like, she's not unlike a lot of women of this time.
Mm-hmm.
So me watching it now, I find myself very frustrated by her just constant accommodation of people, and even when she senses that people are doing wrong by her, she's still like, well, I don't want to offend anybody.
Constantly. Everybody's right. doing things wrong. At the minimum, yeah. annoying her, and at the maximum, raping her.
Right. Yeah. But then we also see, I don't know, there were so many parts of this movie that even when I was frustrated with Rosemary, I felt like in most cases the story explains to you why this is her reaction, because the times that she does say something her situation gets worse almost right away, where like when she does assert herself and she's like, I'm throwing this party. Guess what? I have friends. Mm-hmm. They're coming over. Scary people aren't invited. and like, makes that happen. And then when she speaks up for herself right after, the consequence is she's cut off from access to her friends.
Yes.
And it's like, it. I don't know. They're like seeing her try to accomplish something and then be immediately set two steps backwards mm-hmm. by like the oppositional forces. Like, I don't know. It worked for me story-wise and it made me really sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then another example of that is when she's saying that she's no longer going to see Dr. Saperstein anymore. Mm-hmm. The pain, like this pain that she's been having for months now is not going away. Like something is wrong. And she's saying, I'm not going to drink the herbal drink.
The McFlurry.
It's like a vanilla milkshake.
It kind of looked good. I was like, damn.
Stop drinking that shit. Yeah. And then the husband is so mean about not getting a second opinion. I mean, what?
We see her stand up for herself different times, and then she's shot down, and then in the next scene, we see her drinking the drink again. So it kind of makes, for reasons that I don't think the narrative quite, like, succeeds in, like, changing her mind. And it might have to do with all of this emotional and psychological abuse that she is undergoing by everyone around her. I remember when I first learned about just the concept of gaslighting and like first hearing that term and learning what it was, I remember thinking to myself, oh, like what Rosemary's husband does to her in that movie. Like,
I
made that connection because I was like, oh, that is exactly what gaslighting is. That was like kind of my frame of reference for that. But we already kind of touched on, there's so many times where he is just like textbook abusive behavior in terms of, you know, gaslighting her, like, no, that chocolate mouse doesn't have a chalky undertaste. Just eat it. And
right.
It's like, so much, but it's also, you see that so much in modern movies too. I mean, the movie doesn't look like a dated movie, unfortunately, really. You know, you see, I think it was The Shape of Water with Octavia Spencer?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That just popped in my mind about her abuse of the relationship.
Oh, yeah.
For example, you do see these all the time, mm-hmm.
yeah.
unfortunately, still the submissive woman and the abusive husband.
The chocolate mouse scene, while we're on it, yeah, that was a scene that felt like pretty true to the marital rape scene. Just blew my mind on a number of levels.
Mm, yeah.
But the moose scene, it was like a little bit different of, you can sort of see the like mechanics of what he's doing, but I also sort of understood why it's like, oh, I don't want to have this conflict with this person I have to be with no matter what, because that's how she viewed her life.
Yeah.
And like, what are my options? What is it easier to do? I don't know. I mean, I've been in relationships like that.
Yeah, where you're picking your battles, kind of.
Exactly. Where you're like, finally, the fucking moose. Like,
yeah.
And that's sort of what she ends up saying, because he finds, I think in the space of that scene, three different ways to blame it on her.
Right.
Where he's like, nothing's good enough for you. Mm-hmm. Why are you being mean? She worked on that all day. You're being rude. And like, you know, like, and she pushes back a couple of times. It's not like immediately she folds. She's like, it's gross. It tastes weird.
Yeah.
I think that Ruth Gordon is weird. Fair. But then eventually when he starts to like raise his voice, she is like, fine, I'll fucking eat it. Which is like stuff I know that I have done. I recognize that in my parents' marriage, like, that scene hit for me especially because it felt normal in a weird way.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, in the movie, of course, he has an agenda behind this, which
right.
is he wants to provide the world with this devil baby. And because it helps his career, he'll become a movie star tomorrow. Right. And so he's invested in her eating the damn moose.
Mm-hmm.
But in real life, these things happen all the time. And the man has no other agenda except to keep his wife submissive, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just an act of random violence or abuse.
And
right. so that's why the scene seems normal in the movie. It's, as I say, it's a whole other story, but but nonetheless, it's a sad reflection of all kinds of things that happen like that all the time.
And it's like, as a viewer, it's almost like easier and like more easy to understand that someone would do that to you because they're working for the devil.
Exactly.
Other than that is just what they think is right. Okay to treat someone.
In fact, you almost, I mean, as a movie watcher, you go, oh, well, I see. He's doing that because he wants So, you don't, it's not that you're forgiving
him exactly,
but you say, I see he's got a motivation rather than just random misogyny, you know.
Well, right. I couldn't help but think that, like, in the scene where they first go to dinner at the Castavets, Roman is like complimenting Guy, you did all this great hand gesture and your work in this play was so good. And it's just like, oh, he got complimented one time and now he's going to sell his baby to the devil?
He literally goes, she goes into the kitchen with Minnie for a minute. Mm-hmm. And literally by the time they come back 2 minutes later, this decision has been made.
He's,
okay, sure, yeah. Call my agent.
Lazy bastard. You lazy bastard. Just
my
take
people
a
will
class.
Get to your people. And we'll take care of it.
Gosh, I mean.
I know.
It's just like.
And also makes you kind of want, like, this is an indication that this guy had a serious character flaw, to say the least. Wouldn't she have picked up on this at some point in their marriage?
Kept thinking, it takes her so long to figure, and again, I mean,
but their relationship seems to change pretty abruptly in the movie too. Like, they're in the first couple scenes, they seem to be generally getting along. She's like,
sure.
I want that. Like, she even seems to, it almost seemed like
she's like, let's make love
even
on the floor.
Yeah. Like, she's like, I want to fuck. He's like, okay. Like, it started to seem like, oh, maybe this is a, I did not know anything about this movie. I was like, they're kind of a nice couple.
Right.
Well, it seems that way at first.
But then he turns on her like.
Yeah. But see, like, why did it take this long for them, for her to figure out what it is?
Especially with the Dr. Saperstein thing, it takes her so long to realize that he's on it, because he's also doing like classic, like abusive things, isolating her from her friend. Like, he's like, don't talk to your friends about their pregnancy. Don't read books.
He literally, don't read books. Don't talk to your friends. You're like, no.
Yeah, like, you're a doctor. What are you saying?
And she, well, that's a good transition into like the whole, like, one of the big themes of this movie. And it's like, it's weirdly now looking into knowing what we know about how Roman Polanski views women. And then if you look into Ira Levin's work, where he was not the monster that Roman Polanski is, but his work sort of had a general theme that he also wrote The Stepford Wives, was his mm-hmm. other like major mm-hmm. work of, he was really good at writing villains that were normal men, and that was what makes the story scary, is that it's like mm-hmm. the devil, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, also makes a lot of women in his narratives pretty submissive, and not, I wouldn't say he is a feminist, but he wrote some interesting stories about women.
Sure.
So it's weird. I guess all that to say, I don't know how much of these themes are done intentionally, and how, like, Ira Levin said about this book that it's about atheism, and that people who see feminism in it are just seeing what they want to see. He's like, it's about how people go too hard with Christianity, and then they're like,
but don't you think any director makes a movie without necessarily realizing what things people are going to see in it? Because
sure.
I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, everybody has notions about a movie they've seen that the director knew they would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that the way art works, I think, you know,
right.
that stuff inadvertently affects people.
Totally.
Or they find things that, well, really? That's what you saw? Okay.
And now that seems to be like some of the main takeaways that people have from this movie watching it now, is mm-hmm. like one of the bigger themes of just like ignoring and minimalizing women's physical pain, which happens throughout this entire movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it feeds into the gaslighting thing as well, but there is that like moment where Mia Farrow is standing outside in New York and she's like, pain be gone, I will have no more of thee. I was like, oh, she's gone
Shakespearean on us.
I know. It's like, that was an aside. The between Dr. Saperstein and Guy, they're constantly like, she is saying, I'm in pain, this hurts, something's not right, and then people who obviously couldn't possibly understand what a pregnancy feels like are saying, no, it'll go away in a day or so, you know, ad nauseum, don't read books, don't talk to your friends. And that is like such a proven, I mean, exaggerated version of like how women are treated by doctors. There's like been studies. I have a study here from a book called Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. It's a researcher named Maya Dusenberry. Says that, quote, the tendency to not believe women's reports of their symptoms is definitely connected to these larger, broader cultural stereotypes about women as emotional and irrational and hysterical in the colloquial sense of the word. Women are stereotyped as more ready to seek care. So basically, like, women are more likely to point out their own pain, and therefore it is more likely to be dismissed by
makes perfect sense.
A male-dominated profession, which I'm sure was even more so in 1966.
In the 60s, yeah. I mean, again, you know, having seen it back then, I don't remember having any thoughts about any of these things when I saw it. I mean, maybe a slight annoyance at how dominated she was, because I was kind of a rebel at that time. But it was the 60s after all.
Right.
But yeah, just totally different now, perspective now, because of all this stuff, you know, and the 8 million studies that have been done since then, and all the advances of feminism and everything else. Yeah, and all the, and also the Me Too.
Yeah, I mean, an example of that that we see in the movie is the scene where she goes to Dr. Hill after she's discovered that, like, Dr. Saperstein is in on this coven.
That's another heart. That is, like, a heartbreaking on par for me with the you weren't raped by the devil, you were maritally raped, okay, scene. Mm. And the gaslighting scene with the chocolate mousse, because it's just, like, there are, like, shades of real life in that.
Yeah, it felt very authentic.
Yeah, it sucks. I don't know, let me find the name of the actor who played Dr. Hill, but I thought it was very well, Charles Grodin.
Oh, yeah.
My man Grodes. I thought he gave a great performance, because, you know, in that scene, Mia Farrow is laying out all this research she's done. It does sound a little bit out there.
Sure.
I would be worried about her if someone just came in cold and was like, I'm pregnant with the devil, everything is fucked up. But you can tell she means it so much, and something is wrong, and she needs someone to believe her, mm-hmm. which she tells him. She's like, no one is listening to me.
Yeah.
And he says what any woman who desperately needs to be believed is, he says, okay, let's do something about this. Like, that's like, and she's so relieved.
The relief, yeah, it's like palpable.
You can like feel it. and then he leaves, and it sucks. Like, this just, so many versions of this happen all the time, mm-hmm. of like, you want to keep someone calm, and then you call their abusers to come and pick them up. Like, that happens constantly.
Right.
And it's just so devastating. But maybe I was like reading too much into it, but I really liked the shot where Dr. Saperstein and Guy enter the room, mm-hmm. and Dr. Hill is in the back of that shot.
Yeah.
And you can almost see that he knows he's doing the wrong thing. Or he, like, there's this like look of, dare I say, doubt, 2008. There's like a look, he has a, I don't know if Charles Grodin's got a weird resting face, but I was like, I was like, this motherfucker knows he did the wrong thing. But, and this I think is again something that's like real life, sometimes the way that men interact with each other, they would rather sell out a woman than seem weird to other men.
Totally.
Because if Dr. Hill is the one person who's like, I do believe that all this freaky devil shit is happening, and aligns himself with her, I think that he is afraid of doing that and would rather sell her down the river and literally, you know, force her to birth the devil than be, then go out of his comfort zone socially.
Right. And for a split second, I was like, oh, is the implication that he's also in on the coven thing? But I don't think that's it at all.
So. And that's,
I think
so
it's
much
just,
worse.
I know. I think it's just that, like, he sees this woman, even as the medical doctor that he sees a woman who appears to be hysterical and who he perceives to be like, oh, well, she's pregnant. So, and like, pregnant women be hormonal, that she is like out of her mind and needs to be put back in the care of the men who are actually abusing her. Because men can be trusted and women can't be trusted with their feelings, basically. So, yeah, that was, I mean, it was a very effective, horror moment in the movie when Saperstein and Guy come back into the room.
Right.
But it hurt my heart to be like, fuck, like, Dr. Hill, I thought you were a good guy. Like,
right. I mean, and it's like he, oh, it's so devastating to the point where, like, it almost took me a second to get back into the action after that, because that is such a gut punch. And then she immediately has to, like, literally go on the run mm-hmm. to get away, and it doesn't work.
Right.
And it makes me so sad.
Oh, gosh. We got to take another quick break. So let's process our feelings a little bit, and then we'll come right back.
Oh, jeez.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Celebrate the end of your workday with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as another busy Thursday flies by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
And we're back.
Yeah. Can I just say also, Anthea Silbert, the wife of Richard Silbert, the designer, she did the clothes. Mm. Oh. And can we talk about her clothes for a minute? The little, I mean, sure. They were all literally dresses like you would see on a three-year-old.
A small child.
Yeah. All those, yeah. The lace collars and then the little jumpers. Nothing was fitted. Her body was completely, you know, like those little lampshade dresses. But literally, think about it. They were children's clothes. Mm-hmm. It's just so.
Even when she's pregnant, she looks like a little girl.
A little girl.
It's very strange. Yeah, the art direction and the costuming in this movie is also
fabulous.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the movie looks incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like an attempt to infantilize her and make her sure. seem virginal. Yeah. So almost sure. like equating mm-hmm. her to the Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
But also the little, you know, it just you can't help but have those echoes right. of Roman.
The parallel. Little,
yeah.
Yeah, ugh. Absolutely. The haircut that Rosemary gets makes her be the baldest woman in charge, except she's not really in charge of anything, including her own life.
It's aspirational. I yes. think spiritually it makes sense. She gets the haircut. She's like, I'm in charge now. And everyone's like, no, we hate it. You
yeah.
look bad. And it affects her negatively. She wasn't ready for the haircut.
That haircut should have aligned with her becoming more in charge of her life.
I mean, a different version. Yeah, it's just... It's so frustrating to watch everything she tries in good faith that mm-hmm. in a movie that were kinder to its protagonist would result in something. The last thing I wanted to say about the minimizing pain is, of course, the only people she talks to who believe her are other women.
Yes.
Who are then immediately removed from her life.
Yeah.
I think she tries to call one right before she is forced into going into labor.
Right.
But they take her seriously immediately. They believe her. They're like, well, let's get this fixed. And then they are also ostracized and removed from her life. Mm-hmm. And then we never see them again.
And can I just say also that scene in the phone booth is incredible. When she's trying desperately, she's trying to reach her friend A and the doctor mm-hmm. B. Yeah. And she's in a phone booth, and it's 95 degrees, yes. And people are coming around.
She's
and it's
pregnant.
Just like, and the camera holds on, I lost track of how long it was. The camera held one position.
Yeah.
And it went on for like 8 minutes
Yeah, there's
something.
No cuts or
no
anything,
cuts,
right? Yeah.
And she was great in the
Mia
scene.
Mia Farrow is incredible,
and she
yeah.
was sweating, and it was literally like her life mm-hmm. in that phone booth. She's trapped in this small space. Nobody's responding to her on the phone or mm-hmm. otherwise. And then at the very end of the scene, this man appears outside the phone booth with his back to her,
yeah.
looming. So there's always this. It was like a living hell, literally, mm-hmm. her being in that. It was an incredible scene.
It's a very effective horror movie.
Yeah, it really is.
And Mia Farrow, like her performance is like insanely good.
Yeah,
it's
it really
so
is.
Good. Yeah.
We got to talk about the rape scene.
We do have to talk about the rape scene. I think that maybe the end to talk about that scene is to talk about the scene that comes immediately after.
Yeah.
Because the way it is stylized is, I mean, it sucks that we see rape in movies so frequently. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it's especially like worth discussing. There's a bunch of nude Satanists there. She gets raped by Satan.
Mm-hmm. She does call out at one point, this isn't a dream. This is really happening.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then we cut to the next
morning. Yeah.
I think the next day is, I found that far more disturbing.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, obviously the previous scene is very disturbing, but it's disturbing in a way that's kind of unfamiliar. Because there's a room full of nude Satanists
right.
there.
Yeah, right. Also in that scene,
there's so much fantasy that you can kind
of
float through it. Yeah,
and the horror and unease we feel during that scene is like that's the intention of that scene. But then the next scene, Jamie, as you said, is disturbing for a different reason.
It is
because
so
I have the dialogue exchange here.
Oh, I have it written out.
Okay,
who do you want to be?
I don't want to be Guy, but I don't want you to be Guy.
Nobody wants to be Guy.
I'll be Guy. So the next morning, she wakes up next to Guy. She's kind of disoriented. She's remembering what's happened to her in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And she realizes that she has these like pretty severe scratches on her body.
Yes.
So
Guy says, kind of gesturing to his fingernails.
He's like, don't yell. I already filed them down. I didn't want to miss baby night.
And then
first,
and then Rosemary says, while I was out?
And then he's in the other room and he says, and it was kind of fun in a necrophile sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And just like any sympathy. And in the previous scene where you see Rosemary being in and out and in and out, and then it cuts to the devil raping her. He's not acting that way. He's saying, we'll have sex another day. It's okay.
Right, like tomorrow.
I want you to go to sleep. And so that, I mean, I didn't know what happened immediately after. And I was like, oh, that's some, you know. But then mm-hmm. the next morning, it's a total 180. He was
yes.
like, of course I maritally raped you. It's still legal in most states when
right.
this movie comes out.
Mm-hmm. And then Rosemary says, I dreamed someone was raping me. I don't know, someone inhuman.
And then he says, thanks a lot, like he's already over it.
Right.
And she's calling him.
Yeah. She says, nothing.
And then he tries to touch her, she pulls away. And then he's like, I didn't want to miss the night.
And she says, we could have done it this morning or tonight. Last night wasn't the only split second.
And then he wraps the scene up by saying, I was a little bit loaded myself, you know. So he admits that he maritally raped his wife, even though he said in the previous scene, go to bed, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then where the story gets really complicated is that he didn't maritally rape his wife. He brought her to the devil so that she could get raped by the devil.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that, all the fantasy shit aside, the fact that this scene plays out the way it does and it's realistic, it's just insane to watch, where he's like, yeah, duh, of course I did that. It was fun.
And then
she also
acts like it's kind of no big deal. She's visibly upset by it, but she just kind of has to accept it because, as you said, like, marital rape wasn't even considered rape. It was like, oh, you're married to a man. He can have sex with you whenever he wants, including while you are sleeping and not able to give consent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seemed to go right by her, actually. I thought that was kind of alarming, to say the least.
And to see her, like, she pulls away a little bit, but still is... Oh, it's just a very...
But that was very much with the culture, too, as you say. Like, men, you know, whenever you want it, you just take it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would anybody have thought that the devil raping this childlike, virginal young woman would sort of have this creepy mirror effect as to, you know, Roman Polanski's own activities?
I mean,
it just has a whole other kind of, whole other level of creepy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, God. This, and I'm like, I understand. After watching it, I'm like, I understand why I avoided it for so long.
Yeah, no. And then, I mean, I'm not a mother, so I can't speak to mothering instincts, but I'm just curious if there's anyone out there whose mothering instincts are so strong that when you learn that your baby is the devil, do you still like, yep, I want to be the mother to this devil baby? Is that
a
thing?
I have been a mother. I mean, I am a mother. I had still am.
Did you quit?
I got fired. My daughters fired me when they turned 20. And I have to say, it is an overpowering
Is
love.
It? Okay.
It really is. Neither of my daughters are a devil.
Okay, good.
Although sometimes
I'm so glad.
I wonder. But so I can't really speak to that exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a real thing. But
I sort of bought it because I know what that feeling is like when your baby first shows up. It's the most incredible thing, mm-hmm. unless you're a person who doesn't like babies. But and also because we've been set up through the movie where she has no other interests or nothing else she's passionate about except that.
Right.
So she's... all her juice is going towards being maternal.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sort of see, well, he's mine, and maybe I better... She's rocking the cradle too hard, she says to the woman, don't rock that cradle so hard. And you can sort of... I don't know.
I thought it was an interesting ending where it doesn't... It would be super lame if the movie outright said, and now she's going to be a mother to the devil baby. But the fact that she... It like does line up with her character that she would consider it.
Yeah.
And then also, I don't know. I was mm-hmm. like in a hotel room in Indianapolis, just like staring at the ceiling, like, what would I have done? But if you think about like, no one asks to be born, right?
Right.
And this baby is in a predicament. It seems like, you know, this baby could really use some good influence.
Yeah.
In his life. Yeah.
I mean, there is that great maternal rush right when they're born. And she's doing this towards her infant. The thing that crossed my mind was like, but what happens when he's a teenager?
Yeah.
And
he's
going to
lash out.
And he starts, like, starting wars and whatever, all that shit the devil does. Then what? Is she going to think, geez, adoption might have been a better option?
This could go very, we need to talk about Kevin later on.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess my mind went to one of our very first discussions on our very first episode was the Kill Bill discussion where, like, she learns that she's pregnant. And I think the implication is just that every woman has such a strong mothering instinct that no matter what her circumstances are in life, she's going to, like,
drop everything.
To be a mother.
That was more jarring to me in that movie because we knew that the whole movie was about her other interests.
Right.
With Rosemary, I mean, I think it's like a flaw. I don't even know if it's a flaw, but we don't know anything about her other mm-hmm. than she is a sweet little lady from like Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like implied that she is naive. She doesn't have a large support network in New York and she wants to have a baby. And that's sort of all we know.
Mm-hmm.
That really does make your skin crawl a little bit, doesn't it? When somebody says, everybody has such a strong mothering. Because they don't, actually.
Mm-hmm. I don't have one
God
whatsoever.
I mean, well, you might if a baby popped out. But it's something sometimes I think people don't know whether they do or they don't.
Yeah.
But they said definitely a lot of people don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's always been a thing that's been pinned on women that is like a falsehood.
Definitely.
And that's never asked of men really.
No.
Just like no one has ever...
What about
talking about like
paternal?
That strong paternal
instinct.
Let's make that movie also with Sharon Stone.
Right.
Is there anything else that anyone wants to talk about before we finish?
So the villains of this movie are, we have male and female villains. Basically, all the Satanists are, and it's also worth saying culturally that this is like base level satanic panic, which will only increase going into the 70s and 80s.
And 90s even. Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with what happens to Roman Polanski's wife the next year, because the Manson family is so steeped in that.
Yeah.
And it's just a whole fucking, like, this movie weirdly foreshadows. And also there were a lot of, I forget what, there was like a list of, in the late 60s, it was like The Omen came out. There was a lot of like evil baby movies. The Bad Seed came out in the 50s, which was a movie that used to scare the shit out of me. So it's like taking place with that. But Minnie, for all of her satanic shortcomings, is a fun character. She's really fun to watch. Every time she's on screen, you're like, oh, fuck, it's Ruth Gordon.
She's got charisma.
She's got, look at that headscarf. Look at that blouse. Like, she's got blue eyeshadow on. She's really going for it. And I think that that just is, like, something that we come across a lot, where Minnie's character has 9,000 times the personality that Rosemary does, which is, I don't know, it's almost like in High School Musical. If you listen to our Patreon episode in High School Musical, it's like how Gabriella is the main character, but she's kind of boring. And then Sharpay, the female villain, has all this personality, and we're supposed to hate her. And it's like, but she's more fun to watch.
Right.
Is just another thing. And then when you get to fucking Louie, Laura Linney, what's his character's name?
Laura
Louise, she's in one scene and she's
in a bunch of scenes.
I want to spin off with her. She's just yelling. She's also got a wild blast. I'm like, Minnie and Laura Louise. Okay, a sitcom with two older female Satanists who are best friends. I love that.
It's
someone buy it.
It's like Laverne and Shirley,
but Satan.
They're Satanists. Well, that's another thing I wanted to say about this movie, which is that a lot of movies and a lot of media about witches have a very specific way of depicting witches, and it's usually that they are evil and bad and preying upon innocence. But these days, anyone who identifies as a witch is just, you know, charging their crystals and not doing harm to anybody. Same thing with Satanism. The way Satanism is depicted in this movie and many movies is like, hey, let's get together and help someone rape a woman and steal her baby and stuff like that. And obviously anyone who's doing anything like that is horrible. But modern Satanism is nothing like that. I don't know if you or our listeners are familiar with like modern Satanism, but the members of the Satanic Temple are cool. They are very like progressive. They're very like pro-reproductive rights. They're very pro-science. They're very pro like separation of church and state. Their agenda is very progressive as far as I can tell.
I guess we should make clear that when we are goofing on Satanism in this movie, it's the version of Satanism that is projected in this and throughout the Satanic Panic.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. So, shout out to all our Satanists. And I mean, it's like, it's so interesting because it's like, it's always the, not always, but in some cases, like the subcultures that just have a negative stigma attached to it because of media like this that end up being like very lovely progressive people. I would also lump in Juggalos to that. Juggalos are, if you look at their platform, we got to get some Juggalos in office. They're so progressive. They preach love. They march on Washington. They're out there doing the work.
They are gathering.
They're also really good at hacky sack. They are gathering. Shout out to all our Juggalo listeners.
Yeah. The main thing here is that the way that like witchcraft and Satanism is portrayed in this movie and different other movies around this era is not reflective of like modern witchcraft and modern Satanism and stuff like that. So worth noting.
Oh, we didn't get around to the artist art thing.
Oh, yeah. We never concluded that.
That may be just too long a discussion for right now.
This is one of the harder cases I've ever encountered.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It doesn't get harder than this.
Yeah. Well, how does everyone feel?
I mean, I'm fine with not seeing this movie again, or really any movies that we know have been made by the auteurs who are criminals. There's so much other stuff out there that isn't made by sex criminals that I am happy to watch instead. But it is tricky because this is a well-crafted movie, and I hate to admit this, but I like another of Polanski's movies. It's called The Ninth Gate. It is not a good movie, but I still like it. But like, I'm like, I can't watch this anymore.
Yeah. It's weird. It feels like it's such an individual decision. And it's like the sort of thing where I think when the Me Too movement was first happening, I was very, I think along with like a lot of people were very quick to just be like, nope, done. Bye. See you. Garbage. Bad. And I still feel that way fundamentally, but it's like now that we are having these conversations more, it's like, okay, it's not as black and white as that, especially when it's like, you know, you can't be upset with a friend of yours if you have a friend who loves Rosemary's Baby and is not quite ready to part with it. Like that's
right.
That's a thing. And that means that's like what, when art,
I mean, there's millions of people out there who aren't going to want to part with Michael Jackson's music, you know,
right, like that's another.
So I still don't know. I think what my hope is that we come to a point in just the entertainment that's available to us that so much good stuff has been made by talented people who are not predators and sex criminals, that we can just enjoy that and kind of forget about the stuff that is made by the bad people, but also... Right.
Well, there is also a lot to, for example, to look at this movie now. It gives us, just on this discussion, it gives us an interesting perspective on not just, you know, the movie itself and how it's crafted and how women in it look different than they would have when it came out, but also on the issue we're talking about Roman Polanski and his behavior. And it makes you go, you know, I mean, it can be productive in a way if you can use it to better understand your own feelings about the whole thing, about all kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I wish all sex predators' works were so like absolutely unquestionably bad art.
Yeah.
That it would be a much easier discussion. But it is. I mean, it's like a lot of people are processing how they feel. The only thing I think that we can all agree on is the fact that Roman Polanski got convicted of this crime and continued to work for 40 years is absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah, that's horrible. That's horrible. And meanwhile, other people are like, I think, you know, two people have said he did this or he did that, and their lives are completely over, which is...
Yeah, like you just don't get it.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense that he is... thriving in Paris in a lovely apartment.
Fuck him. It's definitely like an individual journey. Listeners, we encourage you to continue to explore your feelings about stuff like this. Talk to your friends about it. It feels, I don't know, it's like uncomfortable to talk about, but it's, I don't, even having talks like this feels helpful.
Yeah, I think so.
To process. I had one more, I don't know, this movie, because this was the 50th anniversary of this movie last year. There was a lot of media around it, and there's a female horror director named Karen Kusama. My favorite movie she's directed is Jennifer's Body.
Oh yeah, I love.
But she's you know, one of the only prominent female horror directors, and so she was asked about this movie, and I'll just read what she said. She said, quote, "One thing to add here is that Roman Polanski has made one of the greatest feminist parables of cinema, and yet we have to struggle with Polanski the man and the things he did, the crimes he committed. But that, to me, is the enduring possibility of art, that it can stand apart from its maker, and I believe we have to judge Rosemary's Baby on its own merit." I don't necessarily agree with that statement, but the fact that that comes from a very progressive female horror director I thought was interesting and worth mentioning.
Yeah. Well, it's just about 1:15, so we got
to
wrap up.
But, I have to go. I have to go see Dr. Saperstein.
Okay. Oh, no.
Before you
Jessica,
go.
No.
We can...
Tannis, anyone?
Does this movie pass the Bechdel test?
It does. Mm-hmm.
Can I just say, all they did when there were more than one woman in the scene was talk about recipes and saying getting a second opinion. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
There wasn't really any substance exchanged.
Not really, no. But that's pretty par for the course for all the conversations
that we
see.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got to put it in my clothing softener, my fabric softener.
Right. Oh, yeah, there was the laundry scene, too.
Laundry, babies, recipes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in almost every scene, there was an additional conversation about what does your husband do? So
yes. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, your husband is very hot.
Oh, that was one thing where, like, Rosemary repeated her husband's resume to, like, four or five different characters. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know.
He's a loser. How to Kill an Albatross. That's not what it's called.
Right. She was like, he's in this. And yeah, things aren't going great right now, but they will be going good soon. And I was like, oh, God, that seems exhausting. I'm like, I don't walk around just being like, my boyfriend's not sure about his life direction. Like, that sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
Well, there are plenty of exchanges between Rosemary and Minnie, Rosemary and Terry, Laura Louise, the brassy queen of the devil. It passes
the devil's nanny.
The devil's aunt. But she, in most scenes with women, it passes at least once. But the kind of exchanges are very domestic.
Mm. Also, question, does the movie pass the Bechdel test if Mia Farrow talks to herself?
About being that, like, I won't feel pain ever again.
Pain be gone.
Feminist text. Heard it here first.
So let's rate the movie on our nipple scale. It's 0 to 5 nipples based on its portrayal of women. I just don't know. I think I'm going to give it, like, just right down the middle, like a 2.5, because there is, like, on one hand, this is like a movie whose journey we see is a woman who's dealing with all this abuse and who is trying to, you know, she has agency and she's trying to reclaim her agency even further. But I think this story would be a lot more powerful and authentic and probably maybe would have ended differently, or the story would have unfolded a little differently if it had been, you know, written and directed by women, especially a mother who knows what a pregnancy is like and not a man who is a known rapist. I think I might be wrong about this nipple rating, but I don't really know. I still just don't know how to really process this movie.
Yeah, I don't either.
So I'm just going to do the 2.5, and which is still an F when you think about it. But
it's a failing ratio.
But yeah, I wish there was just a slightly different version of this movie in which she's maybe more triumphant at the end, or we know more about her character. I don't feel empowered by this movie. It could be a feminist text, but looking at it through the lens of, you know, our culture in 2019, like, I don't really see that so much.
Sure.
I wish the way this story had played out was that she catches on to all this devil coven stuff sooner. She does her research. She figures everything out. She gets away. She has an abortion. And then she just lives the rest of her life away from all the scary people. So
that would be lovely.
So yeah, 2.5. And I'll give 2 of my nipples to Mia Farrow, whose husband at the time, Frank Sinatra, left her during the shoot of this movie
because he was like,
you're still working? Well, then that's not what I wanted, and I'm going to divorce you.
Well, he wanted her to be in a movie with him, and then she bailed on the movie, and then the movies came out the same day, and Rosemary's Baby did like 5 times the amount of business. So that's the triumphant narrative.
That's a marriage killer.
Sure, yeah. Anyway, so 2 to Mia Farrow, and I'll give my half nipple to the black cat that you see at the very end for a split second in the coven. And cats also have 8 nipples. This is Cat Facts with Caitlin. Anyway, 2.5 nipples, the end.
Jessica, your rating.
Oh, gosh. I'm torn about my nipples.
Yeah.
Sounds very uncomfortable.
Because I know, it does, doesn't it? Because, again, I mean, when you said, like, the horror director considers this a feminist movie, in a way, you have to look at Rosemary. You could look at Rosemary as getting exactly what she wants, ultimately, which is a baby.
Yeah.
And this is the devil's baby, but you're not going to take this baby away from me. I'm going to have this baby.
It has red eyes and hooves, but it's still her baby.
She got what she wanted in a way.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm so uncomfortable about how she's treated. I mean, it's because I'm from that generation. Mm-hmm. My parents, you know, the greatest generation grew up in, you know, we're married and had children in the 50s, and I watched the dynamics between them, and the echoes of that just make me so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I do think the movie's beautifully crafted. It's incredibly written. It's so well acted. It looks gorgeous. And she's terrific. You know, so there's that. So there's great artistry. There's just so much to make you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I'm a little ambivalent about the feminist thing, too. Like, really? I don't know if that's really what I would call a feminist outcome.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What is that? What would that translate in terms of nipples? What do you think? Two and a half? Two, three?
Two and a half.
Maybe I'm with you. Maybe it's two and a half.
Awesome.
I mean, I give a big nipple to the scene in the phone booth. It was just so killer. It's such a great, Hitchcock kind of a thing.
Jamie, what about you?
I'm going to go with two and a half as well. It's a complicated choice. I don't think, it's weird. I don't think we come across stories like this very often where I disagree with Karen Kusama. I don't think that this is like a feminist film.
Right.
But I do think it's an effectively told story about a woman. That made me feel a lot. Yeah, it's an effectively told story about a woman where, for all of the failings of Rosemary's character writing-wise, where we don't know anything really about her family, we don't really know anything about if she has interest, did she go to school, how did she and Guy meet? Like, there's so many things we don't know about her that we do know about Guy, but for the things we do know about her, she does seem pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
Getting through like a mire of gaslighting from everyone around you and still being able to do research. She's constantly seeking out allies who can help her out. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most of the world, and I think the scene that upset me most is the scene with Dr. Hill at the end. I think you see that she does everything she possibly can to gain agency over herself, her life, and her body. The reason I don't think it's a feminist film is because she's not really successful in doing that. So, I don't know. The way this movie rolls out is just like, I feel like I'm still processing it. It's so, I've never seen a movie be this cruel to its protagonist, but also make it clear to you that the protagonist has done everything she could possibly do to try to save herself, and it does not work. It's just like, it's usually, if you see a movie that's cruel to its female protagonist, it's like the protagonist is so severely underdeveloped that they seem stupid and like completely unable to help themselves. But it's like Rosemary is intelligent, she's observant, she's doing everything she possibly can, and the movie does not give her an inch. It's just wild, which I mean,
I think it just has a lot to do with the era and the cultural context of when this movie came out and takes place and stuff.
And for all of its problematic history that goes along and all the baggage that comes with this movie, it does feel worth mentioning that it is like movies like this that allow, it's like I famously said before we started recording, Rosemary's Baby walked so the Babadook could run. And there's a lot of less troubling, more endings. You were just talking about movies made in the past couple of years alone with Babadook, and then you've also got Hereditary that explore, to varying degrees of success, but like explore a woman's psyche and have that be a part of where the horror comes from. So this movie, while very flawed, I think it was at least its influence allowed other good stuff to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it seems like, just like very surface level read, it seems like in spite of her trying to and like intelligently trying to save her own life at every turn, it ended up the way that they wanted.
Yeah.
And that is, I didn't feel uplifted or...
No, she does not come out the victor in this story.
And it's like, that's a difficult thing to watch that I don't think we see a lot, that is true to life in a lot of ways. Not necessarily what I want to see reflected in media, but, you know, yeah. like someone who does everything and the oppositional forces are too much and it just doesn't happen. This movie fucked me up. I'll just go 2.5 just because I love my friends and I want to be like them. 2.5 I'll give. I'm going to give one to, what's her name again? Louie? What's
Laura,
her name?
Louie.
I'd give one to Laura Louise because I was like, what is going on with you over here?
Which, by the way, Roman Castevet is like, oh, she and Minnie are too old to take care of babies.
Right.
It like, has to be you.
Roman's like, those broads will fuck them up. Like, you're just like, oh, I get.
Ageist.
But yeah, but like. And no, but Guy is too. Just Satanists in general shouldn't be raising children. I think we can all agree. Yeah, I'll give one to Louie, one to Terry, RIP, wish I knew you better. And then I'll give a halfie to Ruth Gordon because, my God, what yeah. a fucking performance. And she was turning a look in every fucking scene.
And, yeah. Jessica, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a delight.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so
of
fun.
Of course, yes. Is there anything you would like to plug?
Yes.
Talk about your podcast?
I want to just once again plug my new podcast. Mm-hmm. It's called Winnetka. That's spelled W-I-N-N-E-T-K-A. And it's about my childhood growing up there, which of course took place partly during the era that this movie covers and has all the ups and downs represented in that movie,
yeah.
Except for the devil part. anyway, you can find it wherever you find your podcast.
Great.
And it's a memoir.
Wonderful.
And then go on Instagram to Jessica Harperama.
Yes.
Or go to Winnetka Podcast on Instagram or Twitter. I'm on Facebook too, Jessica Harper.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Great. Yes, follow her in all the places and listen to Winnetka. To
thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
So you have to go see Dr. Saperstein,
la,
right?
La, la, yeah. La, 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 la.
Just a quick note. Jessica did have to leave a little bit before we were done recording the episode. So if there are sections of the episode, it was like, are you just talking over a legend? No.
She just simply was not here for those.
She was not here, and we love her so much.
Yeah, she was amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, so if there are large chunks where Jessica is not talking, we recorded those after she had to leave and then edited them into the episode. So with that, let's plug our little pluggables.
Yeah.
You can follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at BechtelCast. You can sign up for our Patreon, aka Matreon.
Yeah.
It's two bonus episodes a month.
Only $5 a month. And then you get the backlog, so you really get like 30 episodes. And then check out our TeePublic store. Get some merch at teepublic.com/TheBechdelCast. And as always, we love you so much.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Celebrate the end of your workday with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as another busy Thursday flies by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Set sail and save right away when you book your next Disney cruise vacation with UndercoverTourist.com. UndercoverTourist is your secret for savings on all Disney Resorts vacations. And now, fun in the sun with Disney Cruise Lines. How about enchanting entertainment or an exclusive visit to Castaway Key? Anything's possible aboard a Disney cruise vacation. Book now with UndercoverTourist.com, an authorized seller, and get a free in-room decor package with your Disney Cruise Line booking. Plus, exclusive savings at checkout. UndercoverTourist.com.